This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. The Big Interview with Off Script.
Özil came off a Dortmund head. Now Benzema, surely Sergio Ramos!
Gerrard! Hello! Hello! Here we go!
Too far for Ronaldo to think about it. Oh! Absolutely sensational! It's Alex! Oh, that's in! That's in! Unstoppable! In towards Schmeichel. It's come for Dwight Yorke. Cleared. Giggs with a shot. Gerrard! Name on the trophy.
Piara let it bounce. Pepe rather lost it. Torres almost found it. It's come for Cow. It's Torres! Lift off for Liverpool. Rooney! Oh! How good was that? The best moment yet in the mercurial career of Wayne Rooney.
The voice there of Clive Tilsley. We're going to be chatting to him very, very shortly, but we've got to say a big thanks to the Boot Room Collection for setting this interview up. Clive's commentary charts, of which now Chris and I are proud owners, they're available exclusively within the Middle East at the Boot Room Collection stores at the Dubai Mall and the Atlantis. Craig McKelvey has got an incredible array of memorabilia pieces, and Clive's commentary notes do make for the perfect birthday gift. It's actually my other half's birthday today. I will not be buying her some Clive Tilsley commentary notes, but that's not to say that it isn't the perfect gift for your other half.
Exactly that. I'm in possession of both Manchester United's Champions League successes under Sir Alex Ferguson, 1999 as well as 2008, written by the fair hand of Sir Clive Tilsley. Yeah, I don't advise that you pass on that Arsenal invincible season, and that's what I did surprise you with today, Rob.
It's brilliant. Loved
you
it.
You are a closet Arsenal fan.
There you go.
After all. Right, let's get into it. Enough of us banging on, because I want to hear now from Sir Clive Tilsley. Rob and I were granted an audience with a little earlier today, and it's fair to say that I started by confessing to purchasing one of Clive's commentary charts all the way back when, some 3 years ago, and yes, it was that 99 Champions League final chart. Solskjaer has won it and all, and as we quickly learned, those notes, very much a vital part of a commentator's process.
The commentary chart is my crib sheet. It's that little piece of paper that we would have all liked to have taken into our school exams but weren't allowed to. As a commentator, you can cheat. You can spend several days researching a match ahead of kickoff, because one of your responsibilities is to know more about the backdrop to that match than anybody who's watching or listening. How you use the material is probably the skill of the job, if there is such a thing, because it's very easy to bore the viewer with information which is not relevant to what they're watching. That is not good commentary. But it's important to have that research at your fingertips. And in the 4,500 years that I've been doing the job, I have evolved a handwritten commentary chart, which I have in front of me for every game. I tend to compile some of it now on Word documents and so on. I have rather reluctantly moved into the 21st century, but actually copying out the information that I have is probably how I learned as a student. And so consequently, the information goes into my thick skull a little bit more efficiently if I'm writing out the information and compiling out a chart in 3-4 different colors. And then I think the final part of it is that just before the presenter hands to you, when you look down at your notes, which are fairly neat and impressive in the way that they're laid out, it's a kind of psychological prop too, to tell you that you've done everything you can up to this point. You may be terrible for the next 2 hours. You may mess up completely, but you haven't left yourself any excuses. You know, there's an old saying, fail to prepare and you're prepared to fail. And there's no excuse for failing to prepare for anything.
Yeah, I've done a couple of local commentary games on the local league out here, Clive, and I generally tend to have about 19 A4 documents splayed out in front of me. And what impresses me most, I've got your Arsenal Invincibles sheet in front of me. The amount of information you pack into... Very neat, by the way. The handwriting is immaculate. The amount of info you pack into an A4 sheet, which is not just densely packed, but so easily discernible at a glance, effectively, which is, of course, what you need when you want that instant recall in the commentary box. It's amazing I looked at it and I thought, wow, Dennis Bergkamp only scored 4 Premiership goals in that 2003-04 season.
Yeah, overrated.
Blew my mind a little bit. So how, I guess, did you come up with the format for the chart?
Well, the Arsenal Invincibles chart is the record of a season. And that is a separate chart that I compile. And funnily enough, I've just been updating my Premier League charts this morning. So there are all the Premier League charts with all the fixtures and all the appearances and all the results and goal scorers. So it is a genuine prop that I keep. But we publish those to as a memento of a famous season, as opposed to the chart that Chris is talking about, which is a specific match. And actually, the season's grids, as I call them, are an important research source for me in the compilation of the match chart. So I know how many games the players missed, whether they've been a first choice or a substitute, what their goal scoring sequences are, what the team's record home and away and so on. So in a sense, what you've got is actually a research tool for me, but I keep it and I try to keep it sort of neat and presentable because it's a good record of a season. The one that Chris is talking about, the 99 Champions League final, I will have had a grid of Manchester United season, which I will have used in order to compile the match notes. And the interesting thing really about the commentary charts, the match notes, are that they don't tell you anything at all about the game.
Yeah.
So Sheringham and Solskjaer just appear as two substitutes at the bottom of the chart. That is a screenshot of kickoff. It's not a screenshot. It doesn't tell you the story of the night. And so as it hangs there on your office wall or in the downstairs loo or wherever you frame and put it up, you then attach your own story of where you were when you saw the game, who you were with, you know, what you did immediately before, what you did to celebrate immediately afterwards. So it's quite a unique memento in so much that it is the first page of the epic and you add the narrative to it as you remember it. It doesn't actually tell you that Sheringham and Solskjaer came on and scored the goals that won the night.
Yeah, beautifully put there, Clive. And obviously, you've linked up with Chris Stark for this endeavour. I think it's genius. As you say, whether you're hanging it in your bedroom wall or in your downstairs bathroom, as I have done here in Dubai with the Bayern Munich one, and Cheryl and the gang at Boot Room Collection have kindly gifted me a Manchester United-Chelsea final from 2008, which will take pride of place alongside that Bayern Munich one. I guess what I would want to know is, to be clear, that chart that I have of the two individual matches, they are true representations of what you had in front of you on both of those nights, Clive.
Yeah, they are a précis of that in exactly the same style. Funny enough, Sir Alex Ferguson has the originals of both of those Champions League finals. He made a very generous donation to a bowel cancer charity that I'm a patron of in order to take the originals. And he had them framed in his office at Carrington, originally at the Cliff and then at Carrington. And quite a lot of visiting managers would say, hey, I saw your charts yesterday, went in to see Fergie, watch some Manchester United training and stuff. So they were pride of place in his office. Then I think they certainly belong in your downstairs bathroom.
Without doubt.
My only concern is if it's a big downstairs bathroom, I'm not sure where Manchester United are going to win the Champions League again, okay?
That's the one.
It could be many decades, maybe even a century or two, Clive. When it comes to the art form of commentary, we've got so many questions about payoff lines and when to say things, when not to say things. You know, from other sports, when I look at when Tiger Woods won the Masters in 2019, I thought it was very shrewd of the commentary team to not say anything for about 3 minutes and kind of let the atmosphere do all the talking. And there is, to a degree, that kind of skill, I'm sure, in football as well. How did you hone your craft and how did you approach that kind of delicate balance of delivering the kind of appropriate words at the right time?
I had a very good mentor. Some of your senior listeners who lived in the UK may remember a boxing commentator on ITV called Reg Guttridge, sadly not with us anymore. Reg took me under his wing quite early in my television career. I didn't ask him to. He just saw something that he wanted to develop. It was tough love. You know, it was kind of 20th century mentoring. There was more criticism than there was praise. But it was very specific and at the same time gave me an overview of communication, which I think is a really, really important skill to have in the world that we live in now. I think with better communication, the world would be a lot more peaceful, quite apart from anything else. So in our little world, in football, how you use the information is, I think, the skill. And he gave me almost like a journalist's editorial feel for the relevance of information, that particularly with the television commentary where the viewer can see, and therefore you are just, he used to say, the soundtrack to the movie. And there's some great movie soundtracks, but nobody actually goes to a cinema for the soundtrack. They go for the pictures. Television is a visual medium. They can turn you down if they want or watch the game without you. So you need to be adding something to what the viewer can already see. And that perhaps is the talent. It's very interesting. You refer to Jim Nance's commentary of that Masters denouement where Woods walked up through the crowd, met his family to go and sign his scorecard, which is an important part of the sort of ceremony at the end of a major golf tournament. I didn't like it.
Really?
I do believe that commentators speak too much, but Tiger Woods was meeting people, hugging people, kissing people. I wanted to know who they were. And that's where I think that kind of objective view. I never watch football with a commentator because we are the worst people to watch it with. I was very interested that you use that because it is an iconic piece of non-commentary. But I felt that the pictures that we were seeing, this was after the final putt had been holed, and it was an extraordinary victory, one that we never thought we'd see again, that Woods would win at that level again. But I wanted to know who these people were that he was sharing the moment with. And I personally would have done it. I love my golf. I know you love your golf, Robbie. I came over to Dubai about 7 or 8 years ago and played Majlis and Earth and Yas Links and Alzora and Els and stuff. And I'll be coming back.
Sure.
But I just felt that was such an iconic moment. It actually needed some words.
The Offscript Podcast.
I want to get straight back into this as we actually wanted to know just how much of Clive's payoff lines, those moments where a decisive goal is scored, are scripted per se. And, you know, Chris, we use the example of "and Solskjaer has won it." It's etched onto your brain.
That one is. Funnily enough, though, and we actually did say this to Clive a little earlier today, the more so for me is in the semi-final. And I'm being a bit self-indulgent here, but it's full speed ahead Barcelona. That's when Andy Cole tucked home what it turned out to be the winner over in Turin against Juventus. And Clive, full speed ahead Barcelona as Andy runs off to the corner flag to
Brilliant.
Celebrate. Just these little moments that stay with you for a lifetime.
How much of it then is prepped in advance, or is it all largely off the cuff?
It's a question I'm asked a lot. How much do you prepare for eventualities? And it's not cheating. It's not cheating to have a chart which a little sheet of paper which says Manchester United win, Bayern Munich win, two columns. Not with the specific words that you might use, but the significance of the victory, so that you can be as succinct and capture that. Our job really is all about capturing moments.
Yeah.
You know, football happens in moments. We remember moments. Chris has conveniently forgotten what a poor Champions League final that was in 1999.
Terrible.
It was terrible. He's conveniently forgotten that
Bayern hit the woodwork twice in the last 10 minutes before Manchester United scored. Because all of our memories are only of those two extraordinary goals. And Solskjaer has won it, broke the cardinal rule of commentary. I get praise for it to this day, but actually, if Bayern had gone down the other end and equalised, and it had gone to extra time and penalties, and the Germans would have won the penalty shootout back then, there's no doubt about that, there would have been an effigy of me hanging from a lamppost in the Arndale Centre in Manchester before the night was out, because I would have cursed Manchester United by saying Solskjaer has won it when there's still time to play. So there you go. It's the again, you'd have to be a very senior listener to remember the Devon Lock Grand National in the UK, the horse race. But I think everybody's seen the pictures of the horse that was way ahead of all the rest of the field and tried to jump an imaginary fence about 100 metres from the line and fell and didn't win. And we know that sport continues to surprise us. It's why we love it, why we watch it. And as much as a surprise that it was that United scored twice in 2 minutes to win the game, it would have been an even bigger surprise if Bayern had gone down the other end, equalised, and the game had gone on. And I would probably be speaking to you now. Well, I'd be an accountant in Surrey.
Well, you are absolutely right, Clive, to point out it was a dreadful game. From Mario Basler scoring after 5 minutes, the rest was just a horrible, horrible spectacle. And on that point then, and it's a question I'm sure, and I apologise, it's maybe a lazy question, but what is the game that you look back on with the fondest of memories from when you maybe watch it back, you realise that you did such a bloody good job, the game itself ebbed and flowed? What's the standout, Clive?
Well, I'm a great believer that sport belongs in its moment. We talk about the moments, and I don't like the idea of trying to compare a striker from the 1970s or 80s with a striker of today. And I don't like trying to rank games or moments in sport. I think we enjoyed them for when they were, as I say, who we watched them with and what they meant to us at the time. So I don't have a favourite game. And if anybody pushed me against the wall and, you know, put the bamboo sticks under my fingernails, shone the light there, I'd say, well, ask the audience. I mean, it's the audience to decide whether I'm any good or not. That's not for me to decide. Professionally, the match that we're talking about was the most important of my career, because the late, great Brian Moore retired as ITV senior commentator after the 1998 World Cup final. So that was my first season as a senior network television commentator. That was the climax of that season, 30 million viewers in the UK. And if I hadn't shouted the right names of the goal scorers, then again, I would now be an accountant in Surrey. So that was, they'd have found somebody else.
What about interactions you've had with managers over the years, Clive? Has Fergie ever come up to you and jabbed a finger in your chest and critiqued your commentary? Or is that something that was largely, you know, were you segregated from that world to a degree?
I've had the two biggest rollickings of my life with Sir Alex Ferguson. one on the telephone, thankfully, only one in person. He looked after me beautifully as a young commentator. As I say, I was making my way in the business as he was at the height of his powers at Manchester United. I was lucky in that I inherited a good relationship from Brian Moore and actually knew his son. His son, one of the boys, Jason, was a TV director. So I had Jason. I actually stayed at the Ferguson house one night, would you believe, after a game. So I had an acquaintanceship with him, which was very important, but I always knew that it was essentially a professional relationship. However much I was privileged to see him in his downtime from time to time, just reminiscing about moments and sharing a glass of wine with him, I always knew that I was one mistake away from being cut off forever and a day. So the two rollickings that I got from him, both of which were mistakes, I wasn't actually guilty. I still got the hairdryer, but I wasn't actually guilty. I'm still waiting for an apology on either of them. I'm not holding my breath for that, but we passed on. I mean, the very fact that he continued to be very supportive and very kind to me after those two incidents means that I think that he realized that he got the wrong guy. Got it out of his system, and a week later we just moved on. So I think that's probably, I think the greatest the greatest indication of the magnitude of the man and the manager was the way that he moved with the times. He managed Ronaldo differently from how he managed Giggs, because parenting was different in the late 90s to how it was in the late noughties. Everything changes, and a football manager's got to move with the times. You know, some of the senior managers and coaches today can still connect with young 16, 17, 18-year-old players because they're broad-minded, because they can see they can tune in to the lives and the culture and the lifestyles of their younger players, and they have the man management skills, man and woman management skills, to be able to lay down rules for the whole dressing room, but then manage individually within that dressing room when somebody needs a pat on the back or they do need a jab in the chest. And Fergie moved with the times. He was a different manager. There was no hairdryer towards the end of his time, because that wouldn't have worked with Ronaldo.
The Off-Script Podcast.
We've already heard what it takes to be a master of your craft in the main seat, but what are the skill set of the co-commentator? Chris, you mentioned obviously Clive's great co-com was Ron Atkinson back in those mid to late 1990s. Ali McCoist has very much leapt to the forefront of that role in recent years. What about the skill set that a co-commentator brings to the table?
My view of the co-commentator, and if I work with a younger co-commentator for the first time, this is the message that I give them. I have dreams where I've scored in Champions League finals myself and won the World Cup for England, would you believe? But I've never actually crossed the white line. I've never been across that white line out into the middle where football matches are won and lost. You, the co-commentator, have.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you've necessarily won a Champions League, but just to have played at any elite level of the game, to have been a League Two player or a professional in you know, one of the Middle Eastern leagues, you are still in a very, very small group of elite players at the head of the game, because we all wanted to be footballers, and only a chosen few are good enough to earn a living from the game. And it is the great meritocracy of the world, football, because however much money you've got, you can buy a football club, but you can't buy your way into a football team. You've got to be good enough to play at an elite level of football. But being good enough to play and having an understanding of the game to come back and tell the rest of us who will never go there what it's like down there, that is a different skill.
Yeah.
You know, that is the ability of a good manager or a coach to relate to those younger players, as we've been just talking. And in a way, the co-commentator is talking to an ignorant audience. It's an audience that think they're very informed, because we all think we know our football. We've all got opinions on football. But unless you've been across the white line out there in the middle where football matches are won and lost, you don't really know. And so somebody who has an understanding of the game to be able to come back and relate that to the rest of us, I think that is a great skill. And I keep reminding Mr. McCoist that he is, I would say, probably after Dalglish and Law, as iconic a footballer in Scotland's history. He is a funny man, and he is an entertainer, but do that as a secondary job, Ali, because you've got as much gravitas, your CV is as strong as anybody else who's broadcasting. And I think he sometimes needs a reminder of that, not to fiddle as if he needs to make us laugh, because when Ali McCoist analyzes a football goal, he invariably tells us something that we haven't seen.
Yeah.
And that is the skill of the co-commentator.
Yeah, very good.
As the game has evolved, Clive, and of course, you know, we've got in many ways the art of punditry, or the industry of punditry, is now revolving more around quotable, bankable kind of social media content that has the capacity to go viral. You seem to see a lot of these guys turn into somewhat caricatures of themselves. I mean, Roy Keane would be a great example of that. Do you think the overall quality of insight and knowledge in the game deteriorated as the circus around the game and the kind of desire for this sort of virality of content has kind of increased in much the same way as, for example, tabloid newspapers, when they went online, kind of tried to appeal to the lowest common denominator?
I don't want to blow the proverbial smoke, Robbie, but that is such a good question. And we could talk for the next hour about 21st century media and the role that it fulfills in all of our lives, and how obviously new generations consume their media in different ways. The end of the long read, if you like, everything has got to be available and understandable within 20, 30 seconds. And that is a challenge for the modern communicators. A challenge for you guys, it's a challenge for me. And we have to understand our audience. I mean, the audience are the most important people. We've got to serve the audience first and foremost. It's nice to get a pat on the back for something that you've said or something that somebody remembered. But you soon find out in the social media world whether it's actually resonated with a lot of people or whether there are a lot of people who don't like it at all. And that, you know, that's a difficult balance. The instant review is there now. Not only the instant review, but the instant cancel is there. You know, I can end my career at any moment just by saying something thoughtless, careless, insensitive. And so there is a different jeopardy now that comes with mass broadcasting in particular, which maybe makes you a little bit more guarded. And that's, we're just scraping the surface of talking about what you are saying. And it's interesting that, and I wonder whether you'd say it to his face, that you think Roy Keane has become a little bit of a caricature of himself. I know him.
Probably not, and if I'm honest.
And I don't disagree with you. I think the problem is that we see so much of him now.
Yeah.
And there is kind of only so much he can say about a football match. I think that we do respect his view because of who he was. But I think the first thing you've got to understand when you're listening to anybody of Roy's standing in the game is that they are one-offs, all of them. Ferguson, Keane, McCoist, they are one-offs. They are all a bit odd. They had to be to get to the level that they did in this hugely competitive world of football. And Roy's idea of being competitive would be different to you or I. You know, if we're coming down the last and we're all square, Robbie, we'll be looking at each other. We might even stop talking to each other. We might be, you know, trying to kind of silently, and nobody ever wishes ill on a fellow golfer, but we're kind of thinking, I hope he's in a divot, you know, with that drive that he's at 280 yards down the middle. So Roy is that times 10. And Graham Souness is a really, really close friend of mine. And when Graham started to manage, when he came back from Rangers to manage Liverpool, he had a major flaw. He couldn't understand players who weren't as competitive as he had been. And therefore, he couldn't tolerate them. He couldn't manage them because they weren't like him. And I think Roy might have had some of those same issues. And it is a difficulty. And Graham would tell you he had to mellow. He had to see other people's weaknesses in order to try to improve them. And he had to tolerate them. He had to live with the light and shade that there is in any group of people that come together. And it's the collective that's important. You know, the lowest common denominator is the level that you're working from. And I do think with Roy that if he sees a player who isn't prepared to hurt an opponent in order to win a game, he actually doesn't have an understanding of them. He doesn't understand their mentality. We can understand it because we don't want to get hurt. You know, I can't recognize greatness in many footballers, but I can recognize a bit of cowardice.
Yeah.
I can recognize a little bit of self-preservation when somebody pulls out of a challenge. I can see that. I can sympathize with that. I know what that guy's going through. He doesn't want to break his leg. I get that.
What you're saying, Clive, is that what
makes him... I've gone through most of my life without breaking a bone in my body. So, you know, but that's the challenge, if you like, for the editor who's working with Roy Keane to try to mold him like a manager would to become perhaps a more understanding, a more sympathetic pundit.
Fair. I look at, you know, I've already referenced Ron and Ali. I was a huge fan, a good friend of the show, the late, great Ray Wilkins. I remember he co-commed a game where his insight on Javier Hernandez's movement has always stayed with me. It was fantastic. I think Danny Higginbottom, who I know got poached by ESPN over the States, I think he's a fantastic co-commentator. Robbie and I talk a lot, Clive. Gary and Jamie, as good as they are pundits, we're both not fans of Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher as co-commentators. For some reason, I don't think they work. I guess what I'm getting to is, who are the individuals now that you admire? You know, Robbie and I are big fans of Jim Nance and Tony Romo from American football. Ian Dark and Jim Watt will always stay with me from a boxing standpoint. And I mean this, forget Mr. Tyler and Mr. Gray, as good as they were for Sky Sports, you and Ron on the Champions League coverage, that is football for me. But who do you look up to?
I mean, what everything that you've just said is your opinion.
Of course.
That's your opinion, Chris, and Robbie's probably shaking his head on the other side of the desk.
You know,
that is the beauty of this, really. We're not in a business where we can produce more car parts than the guy on the next production line. So we're not even strikers who get measured on the number of goals that we score. We're not really responsible for how many viewers or listeners a program get. I mean, we are to a lesser degree, but ultimately people will turn on to watch the product. My kind of commentating hero, who again is sadly not with us, was the late Pat Summerall. Now, if you watched it, NFL Monday Night Football back in the day, Summerall was the straight man to the great John Madden. John Madden is one of the most famous voices in sporting broadcasting. And Madden was the former coach. He was the Ron Atkinson equivalent, really. A little bit mad, a little bit crazy, a little bit unpredictable. But from time to time, as he's searching for the right phrase, he'll come out with an absolute killer, which you'll remember the entire game Super Bowl by. And that was Madden. Summerall cleared the stage for him. Summerall was selfless. Summerall did the hard yards. Summerall built the drama of the game. He did it in a very economical way. He had a voice which would wake the dead, which helps. but he was very appreciative of his colleagues' part in this team. And so he was, if you like, the assister to the goal scorer, who was Madden. And I think that's I like economical, succinct commentators who value every word that they speak. Commentators who don't think out loud. Commentators, it's sometimes said that a good referee is one that you don't notice.
Yeah.
I would add to that and say a good referee is one that you don't notice until there's a big call to make, and then they get it right. And I think that's actually quite a good definition for a commentator. Somebody who isn't trying to make a name for themselves, isn't in your face, doesn't, as the teams come out, start like that. I mean, if you start like that as the teams are walking out, where are you going to go if it's a good game, you know? No, the teams, here they come, and we'll take it from there. But then when the big call comes, somebody's got some words.
Love it.
Yeah, there's a very famous piece of commentary, which a lot of people will, we mentioned Martin Tyler a little bit earlier, the Aguero goal, which won the title for City. And the way he shouted Aguero is what's always remembered about that. The greatness in the commentary is what he said next.
Yes.
And do you remember what he said next?
Yeah, he said, drink it in, you'll never in your life see anything as incredible again.
Or I swear, like you'll never see anything like this again.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
That is actually, we're talking about what Reg Guttridge gave to me, that editorial call, that journalism. It's quite a big call to make, that you'll never see anything like this again. In the moment, to say that, you might as soon as you say think, have I overdone that? But actually, even with the passing of time, even with Michael Thomas's goal at Anfield, which was a little bit different, even with the dramatic City win in the title, was it 3 years ago when it went down to the last 5 minutes between them and Liverpool, we will never see anything like that again. And that is a huge call from somebody who's very experienced, seen a lot of football, and at that moment his brain is saying to him, do you know what, this is absolutely unique. And he found the right words to capture that moment forever and a day. So if ever you hear the Aguero goal and somebody tries to stop it after the shout of Aguero, say no, roll it on, because the best bit's still to come.
I love
that's
that,
that's what defines a great commentator. The words that capture the moment.
The Off Script Podcast.
Right then, into the final few minutes of our conversation tonight with the legendary football commentator Clive Tyldesley. Now, he stopped short in a few minutes of telling us who he supports. He does, however, reveal who he is rooting for in the Premier League title race. That after he gives us a little idea about what's next with Clive's commentary charts.
Yeah, I mean, obviously May time is trophy time, and it's not just the league title and the Premier League title and the Champions League, but in the last couple of seasons we've done charts for Wrexham and Plymouth Argyle and Stockport County, big seasons, big promotion seasons. We've done big playoff finals, Sunderland and Luton Town in the last spring. So I'm certain that there will be some new charts. Yeah, I mean, you haven't asked me the question which I get asked most of all, thank goodness, because I wouldn't answer it anyway. Who do you support? And actually, I'm afraid to say that I would never wear a half and half scarf. Don't worry about that.
Good.
But who do I support at the moment? Well, I quite like Arsenal to win the league, because the last Arsenal chart we've got is the Invincibles chart.
Yeah.
We really want Tottenham Hotspur to win something, because there's loads of Tottenham fans out there. And at the moment, our only chart is them winning a Champions League semi-final in Amsterdam when they lost the final 3 weeks later to Liverpool. So I've now almost become biased towards teams that haven't won anything for a while. And I'm already thinking, well, we could make a chart about that in the spring, or you know, but that would be a great team to win a playoff final and so on. So that's how much this little business has now skewed my judgment of football, that it's turned me into a secret gooner. Would you imagine that?
Wow. I tell you what, I'll make a little request, and forgive me here. I looked through the list. I don't think you've ventured too far into continental Europe, but if Bayer Leverkusen complete this season in all competitions unbeaten, Clive, I'll put in an order now, a Bayer Leverkusen one, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. Unfortunately, there's an if in that sentence. Again, here I go, pedantic.
That is a big if, you're right.
It's very difficult to... It's like one of those silly games that you get in a Christmas cracker where you've got to try and get all three balls balanced in the holes at the same time. And as you get one in, the other one comes out. And, of course, the further into a season you got... And Bayer Leverkusen know all about this, because they were Bayer Leverkusen, you know. They actually, back in at the start of this century, they had a very, very good team which threatened to win league titles, threatened to win a Champions League final, and pretty much blew everything in the space of 10 days. So that can happen. But, I mean, this happened to Liverpool two seasons ago, didn't it, where they only finished with the FA Cup and League Cup. I hate this. I mean, going back to golf, sorry, Chris, but going back to golf, I hate this notion about, like, Tommy Fleetwood's never won in the States. Yeah, but what about all the guys that go home on Friday night? Don't call him a choker or a loser. He's there every week knocking on the door. That makes him an outstanding player. And we all know in golf that, you know, one lucky bounce, one bounce off a sprinkler head or something, and that can make the difference over four rounds. And Fleet was good enough to win in the States. So don't hold that against him. He'll get over the line eventually. The chokers, the losers, are the people that go home on Friday night.
You're
and
right.
The same in football. If you give yourself a chance, as Leverkusen are doing, then you're good enough. I think you are, by definition, good enough to go on and win it, win everything. Whether they do or not will probably come down to a bounce of the ball or a refereeing decision or a deflection or an own goal. And that's got to go your way. It went City's way last year. Can you remember who knocked City out of the League Cup? That's a good quiz question. Who denied Manchester City the quadruple?
Oh, this is a good one. Who denied City? It was...
Wasn't Chelsea, was it?
It wasn't, no.
No,
I'll put you out of your misery. It was Southampton.
Yes, it was.
Southampton knocked them out of the Carabao Cup.
2-0 down.
And that it can happen on one night. You know, right. Probably when they were least expecting a defeat, it happened, and they only finished with three.
It's amazing.
There's no such thing as only finishing with three.
I didn't think in all of this conversation, Clive, I'd come away from a chat with Clive Tilsley thinking, I think he wants really to be a golfing commentator.
Yeah.
Was there ever any opportunity?
No, you're going to be able to play the game to commentate on golf, sadly.
Well, was there ever any chance of you moving into any other sports at the early part of your career, Clive?
I've done odds and ends down the years. I did basketball at the 96 Olympics for the BBC in Atlanta, the second Olympics of the Dream Team, which was good fun. You come home from commentating on basketball with a sore neck because I'm 6 feet, but everybody was about six. Everybody I met was at least 6 feet six. So I was constantly looking up, having conversations with these former players who were other commentators. And rather like a golfer, sometimes for no reason at all, will start practicing their fresh air, their imaginary swing. In the middle of a conversation, a basketball player starts practicing free shots. It's a really, really strange thing. Yeah, exactly that. What are you doing? Practicing my free shots. We haven't got a ball. Yeah. So that was a good experience. I did some rugby league way back in the day. That I've been fortunate to have earned my living from leaving university and going into local radio. I had a late night rock show for about 3 months, and then I managed to volunteer for the first football commentaries, and I've been stuck there ever since.
What a man. A big, big thank you to Clive Tilsley, a childhood hero of mine. He still is. To be fair, and what a top bloke.
Yeah, absolutely. He's definitely got, I was very impressed by his golf knowledge, put it that way.
So.
That sort of blew me away. And, you know, he's still got the gift of the gab, that is for sure.
Proper, so he is. A reminder, Clive's commentary charts available exclusively within the Middle East at the Boot Room Collection stores. You can find those at the Dubai Mall and the Atlantis. A big shout out to both Craig and Cheryl for setting up that interview with the legend that is Clive Tilsley.
The Off Script Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.